The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
You're very welcome back to Saturday's Off the Ball. Delighted to have Brian O'Driscoll alongside us in the studio. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Glad to be out of the house.
First thing everyone's saying.
We're going to have to do a dad podcast after this where we bemoan our lot of being stuck inside for 2 days solid.
But I don't know. Like, some of my wife's friends were saying, oh yeah, we got through, you know, such box set. It was like, but you have kids. How could you possibly have watched any box set? Like, it was impossible to watch anything in a continuous
Did
manner.
Did they mean the Minions / Despicable Me box set?
Possibly. And all three Toy Stories. It's only like a third of it, and then no. Next thing. No, I want to see.
As the hours tick by, the periods of contentment become shorter and shorter. So on day one, for the first few hours, you might get an hour or 2 hours in a row where there's no row. By the end of day two, you're doing well to get 10 minutes without a row.
I was just trying to avoid painting. It's the one pastime that I cannot do.
Why would you end up painting?
I'm not painting myself. I'm not Keane Healy.
Painting with the children.
Yes.
Oh, I thought you meant painting the house. That's something that was, everyone's a bit bored. And you make that terrible mistake at 2 o'clock on Thursday going, I'm a bit bored. And well, you can paint the bathroom then. You mean painting with the children?
Painting with the kids, yeah. It's the one thing. I'll do anything but not painting.
Why?
It's just so messy. I can't. The cleanup after.
You're too much of a perfectionist.
Yeah, I just thought, oh no, not for me. I'll do anything else. Anything else, but not painting. But there was
your
painting yesterday.
Trying to be artistic.
My wife does the painting role.
Wow. All right. Fair enough. Yeah, my memory, I think, of when being a kid, though, was that I enjoyed the snow. Whereas now, very much, I find it's like outside for 8 minutes and already there. It's cold. It's freezing. I want to go back in. It's like, no. We need this to drag on for as long as possible.
They just have it easy, don't they? Warmth, TV and box sets. And
anyway, we're here to talk rugby and Dave's guns, which he has sort of brought out. You've worn an appropriate jumper for the cold weather.
It's not the weather for the gun show.
But you've sort of gone half and half. You can still see the guns.
Yeah, you've kind of mixed it up. You've still gone tight, right?
But
you've loaded
and an under t-shirt.
Why does he never have to talk about his guns?
It's not appropriate for him to have guns. You know, he was a professional rugby player.
That's actually the outfit that I dress my son up every day for Montessori, where he refuses to wear jumpers. So I've got to put that long sleeve vest underneath the t-shirt. That's actually the look of a 3-year-old right there.
Or he looks like an adult, maybe. Can we go down that route?
Anyway.
Can we move it on for the reason he's actually here?
Let's talk a little bit about the rugby. We haven't actually spoken to you since the win over Wales. 3 wins from 3. I sort of feel with the analysis that we've all been sort of schmithified, that we have to look for the negatives and what's Joe going to be focusing on when he gets in on Monday morning and they play it all back. And we sort of forget that we've won 3 games and we're on course for a championship and potentially a grand slam. Are the positives far outweighing the negatives for you so far?
Yeah, absolutely they are. I think you want to pick holes because you're dealing with perfectionists. Joe's definitely a perfectionist. You know, ultimately, as a player and as a coach, you're never going to reach that utopian moment or game, but you strive to do so and get as close to it as you possibly can. And understanding players like Johnny Sexton and Conor Murray, you know, they do have incredibly high standards. So there's always an opportunity to nitpick when your performance has been maybe a fraction below the barometer that you've set yourselves. That said, I thought some of the attacking rugby, some of the scores were absolutely brilliant. I think Wales will be disappointed at how easy Ireland managed to get over the line from close quarters, from, you know, 5-10 metres out, particularly the Keane Healy and Dan Levy tries. You know, the Keane Healy one was a latch. You know it's coming. You've got to stop that. But, you know, to our credit, it was a brilliant latch from Peter O'Mahony, who I thought had another outstanding 70-odd minutes, did lots of the clean-up work. And I know we'll talk a little bit about Jamie Heaslip later on. I think Peter O'Mahony is now moving himself into that Jamie Heaslip role of doing all that unseen stuff, all the things that most people... goes unnoticed.
He's getting a 7 out of 10, but his teammates are giving him a 9 out of 10.
Oh, no, I have to say I love seeing the work that he does, the cleverness of his play, the small little mop-up jobs, plugging holes where it needs be, pinching ball, being annoying, all the really effective stuff that ultimately leads to other players looking good. Mm. And that latch on Keane Healy epitomised Peter O'Mahony. I kind of had to rewind a couple of times to see who it was, because he was the difference in getting him over. Keane Healy's a powerful guy, but it's that latch, that extra shunt that gets someone, you know, from 2 yards out to, you know, to 2.5, which is the try line.
Has he always had that in his game, or is actually that sort of on scene work you're talking about, has he stepped up a level since Heaslip has left the scene?
Probably. I think he's always had it, but I think it has stepped up a level. I think he's allowed to do more of it now. Also, he wasn't a mainstay in the team when Jamie was there. It was almost one or other, because Stander was over playing six and Pete was on the bench. So now that he's a mainstay in the team, Stander's a big ball carrier. Levy's, you know, going about his business as a true out and out seven. So I think that mop up job, there's a role for him to do it, and I think he's doing it incredibly effectively. So, you know, talk about the positives. Take Johnny Sexton's goal kicking apart. It was a very, very good performance, save for the couple of tries that we conceded towards the end. But I always say it, when you have a good victory and there's plenty of room for improvement, I almost think that's a coach's dream ticket, because you're never going to get carried away with yourselves as a team when you know that you've conceded three tries and that you're still looking a little bit vulnerable in the wide channels, which is something that we've been talking about for months, and yet we still conceded there again. And you can be sure that Scotland will identify that and will do something similar to what they did against England.
There's a lot in that then. Sexton, what's he like those couple of days when you're back in camp after he's had a bad day off the kick and tee?
Well, he'll be really pleased with his overall performance. He'll be ready because his standards are higher than he achieved. He does beat himself up. He's a bit Johnny Wilkinson-esque, where maybe not to the point of going out and practicing for 10 hours, you know, after having a bad day's kicking, but he'll definitely be irritated that it could have been a close to perfect performance because of how well he carried himself, how aggressive he was, how good his timing of pass, the quality of pass. So the rest of his game was very, very good, but ultimately, you know, you need to keep the scoreboard ticking over, and it was on 30 minutes. It was a bad reflection for territory and possession, where we were, was it 15-6 down? It kind of felt we really needed to score next, because Wales, with the lead, are a very difficult team to chase down.
Would you expect him to be flawless from the kick and tee against Scotland? Like, that's the kind of fella that he is.
Yes, probably. I think he is someone that tends to bounce back. I was sitting doing TV with Johnny Wilkinson, and he was trying to pull apart each kick as he missed it. I'm wondering whether that back issue was, you know, was having a knock-on effect to his alignment as he was approaching the ball, or whether he was trying to overcompensate. You know, we always try and find a reason for someone having an off day, because those three kicks are very unlike him. So maybe there was something in that. Interestingly as well, it was also mentioned, you know, the tap and go. Johnny's always been someone that has gone for tap and goes and an opportunity where it arises. But
even in that situation where... But
I thought that was a bad decision. And whether it was in the back of his mind that he wasn't totally confident with how he'd been kicking the ball, and that was an opportunity to maybe relieve a little bit of pressure from himself. I don't know, because Johnny gives out to his wingers the whole time if they're not ready for a cross-field kick from anywhere on the pitch. So I wouldn't do him a disservice, but I just wonder, somewhere in the back of his head, did he think, do you know what, you know, tap and go, we'll score here and that'll be that. So, you know, there'll be no concerns over kicking goals.
Well, there was talk that he had said to them at halftime that they're turning their backs on penalties.
Okay.
And just keep an eye out for this. And then obviously he did go for it himself. It was a little isolated when he did it.
It was defended very well, in fairness. George North, and I don't know who the, I think it was one of the sub props, actually managed to get him down. But North defended it brilliantly. Was it Stockdale's wing that they attacked down? But the Cardinal rule, that was a penalty on the 22 just inside the 15, which ordinarily you would, which is a two score game, which was massive. So it was a poor decision, you know, retrospectively, and at the time of it, you know, you it has to be a sure thing if you're going to tap and go from there.
Sexton wouldn't have come off unless he was struggling with his back injury, and Murray playing the 80 minutes. It seems as though that Marmion and Carberry are going to sit on the bench for the full 80 unless there is an injury. Is that a lack of trust in them, or is that, and is that just, actually, we have two world-class players, we will keep them on the pitch for every single minute if they're fit?
Well, if you really want to win the Six Nations against the best teams when the game's in the balance, you got to keep your best players on the pitch. I don't think you can run the risk of bringing a player who won't be able to impose themselves quite as well, and that's the reality. Joey Carberry doesn't have the experience yet. In time, he might be a player of Sexton's caliber. We'll have to wait and see that. Marmion is still a good way off Conor Murray, realistically, both his quality of pass, decision making, his ability to be able to read the game, even though he's quite effective when he does come on. So again, in tight games, you can't just have a snapshot thought, sure, we'll just throw on, or let's mix this up here.
No,
the difference, the quality of difference between first and second choice nines and tens is still substantial enough to keep those boys on in the tight affairs, for sure.
It's incredibly rare in the Six Nations that you can concede three tries in a game back to back and win both those matches, because they're usually so, so tight. But Ireland have managed to get away with it. You were talking at the roadshow ahead of the Wales game about where the problems were for Ireland out wide, and at times they were ending up with the wrong players in the wrong positions, they're ending up with front rowers, and that wingers' eyes will light up when they see that. Were the reasons that Wales scored three tries similar to the reasons that Italy scored three tries?
All three tries were slightly different, and for varying reasons. In fairness, Wales on the Gareth Davis try, they just came at them, and Ireland soaked a little bit and they got in behind, and then it was a breaking ball. A bouncing ball is so difficult to defend again. Sometimes it's the best ball when you see a bounce pass, because everyone switches off for a split second, and if it bounces and skids up into someone's arm, it's only that hundredth of a second of a switch off from defence, and there's an opportunity. And Gareth Davis, there was a potential knock on and maybe a yellow card from Bundiaki in his contact. The ball broke to the ground, Gareth Davis picked it up, and immediately Ireland were on the back foot. Stockdale was retreating, and a good nine with good footwork will pull a team apart like that, and James Ryan didn't have an opportunity to get across. So it was a pretty impressively taken try from his perspective, from Gareth Davis' perspective, and I suppose a little bit opportunistic, but there were good value for it, because they're a side that's able to score in limited phases, and they showed that there. And the Stockdale error on the second one would be small cause for concern. I think he's been really, really good going forward. Not just his try scoring. Obviously, he's got 8-7, which is some strike rate from an Irish perspective. It's kind of New Zealand numbers, really, for wingers that you see coming in. Julian Sevilla and Dougie Howlett, hit those numbers, where we never associate that with Irish players. So going forward, it's been brilliant. Not just his try scoring, but his small touches, his understanding when to release the pass, the timing of it. So I've been very, very impressed with him going forward. And his tackling, it's his decision making in defence, is what's still causing him some concerns. Ireland got very narrow on that Shingler try when Wales went out the back, and Bundiaki actually had it, not covered. We were still going to be stretched, but Stockdale came flying in. And again, if you're going to come shooting in as a winger, you've got to stop the ball, or you've got to force there to be a big looped pass to allow for the scramble defence to get in behind and realign. And he just left too much work for Rob Kearney to do on Navidi. So,
do you sense he's been told to shoot in? That actually he's been told to press high and be quick off the line?
Maybe
in each other. It's a cohesion.
Enough
time
on the pitch, a cohesion thing, absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Even if it looked like, well, say from Gordon Darcy's point of view, even if it looked like you were not going to get your man, he would still focus on his man.
Only
once. He'll trust you that somehow, by hook or by crook, he'll make the tackle. Whereas maybe if it's McFadden coming in off the bench on Chris Farrell, or it's Stockdale and Chris Farrell, these guys haven't spent any time together in that test arena. Stockdale thinks, do you know what? I haven't spent enough time with this guy to trust that he's actually going to get his man here, so I'm going to bite down. And then Farrell does get his man, but Stockdale's out of the game.
Yeah, I absolutely do think that there's a lot in that. I think the chat coming from the inside out, you have to, particularly when it's inexperienced players like Bundy. Yes, he's inexperienced internationally, but he's playing a long time, so I'm sure his chat is probably quite good. So he has to be roaring at Stockdale to stay out, that he's going to push through. That communication and conversation alleviate so much fear and concern as the last defender or second last defender as Stockdale was with Kearney closing the gate. I think you have to understand that he hasn't been in that situation an awful lot, and he'll react to you shouting at him and telling him exactly what you want him to do. If there's silence, he's left to make a decision on his own. And you know, maybe it's that Ulster slammed the gate an awful lot. You look at Trimble and Bow and Gilroy, they all like to slam the gate closed, and he's seeing that on a day-to-day basis. So maybe he's thinking, do you know what, I can close off this problem. But it happens a lot quicker in international rugby than it does Pro 12 and European rugby, and that's the difference. You don't have as much time on the ball, or you don't have as much time to make those decisions in defence, and he was caught out as a result of it.
So who does get the blame when a winger keeps his back to the open field and faces the touchline to keep an eye on his marker, on his man, and the ball never actually arrives to his man? It's the guy on the inside that scores the try. Well,
it really depends on what your system is. Like, if you're willing to leave the last man over, you look at a lot of defences, particularly England's. I think of Leinster's defence as well, and to a degree, Ireland's defence isn't as aggressive as either of those two. But a lot of the time, they're just playing man on. They're not looking at drifting off. So I think there's nothing wrong if Stockdale doesn't shoot in one. If he just plays up, he was still going to be leaving Schindler left over to Kearney. Yeah. But sometimes you just have to leave that for the last man to close the gate. Whereas for him to shoot two in, you know, you're taking a big risk there. And Bundy looked as though, as much as he was going to, you know, be stretched a little bit, he was still going to make that tackle. So the more situations he finds himself in, Stockdale, this is, of understanding, okay, this is what happened last time. You know, he'll learn a huge amount from that one, where he realised, you know, I overread that, and I tried to solve a problem that hadn't fully presented itself. Yeah. I could have stayed off for another second or two and allowed Bundy to connect with me, and we could have solved it as a collective, whereas he instinctively just decided to shut it himself.
Do you remember making those kind of obvious misjudgments in your early years?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. There was later on in my career too, when I got a bit cocksure too about, you know, shooting on my own. We had massive success with it in 2009, throughout the Grand Slam year, and then on the Lions tour we were slamming the gate shut, and then in the November internationals I picked up some intercepts, and then we played against France in 2010 over in Stade de France, and I knew what play was coming from the French team from analysing them, and I actually overread it. Like, not only did I go one too far in, I went two too far in, and I went for an intercept and I missed it. And I absolutely punished the whole backline as a result of it. It was shocking defence, like really appalling defence. So there's, you know, because I had actually the previous year, they'd done the same play and Box East was playing 10 and I'd absolutely smashed him from 13 into 10. On this occasion, I went from 13 into trying to intercept the pass from 9 to 10. It's like, what? Actually, even explaining it now, I'm thinking that is, like, mad. It was like
2-year-old defenders.
Yeah, but, like, not far off it. It was.
I've got this, guys.
It was. It was just so over.
Are they looking at you going, what
comfortable
is this clown
with
doing?
With this. I've got this solved. So I still, you know, what was I at that? I was 30 years of age. Like, that's pretty inexcusable for an experienced player like that. So I was still making those errors, not from an inexperienced point of view, but just being overly confident. So it's gonna take him time, absolutely, to appreciate the time that he has, you know, limited on occasion, but sometimes he'll have more than he appreciates. And when he gets that communication from whoever his centre pairing might be, he's got to have that chat. Push out. Don't slam the gate. And also coming from Kearney too, I don't know what sort of chat he's giving there. He's the linchpin, and because he's the one ultimately that will have the last defender. He sees what major trouble there is. And first, he tried to do his best on Navidi, but you know, his skills were too good to put Schindler away. So
is this a natural thing then, almost, when we do have so many changes in the back line and there's constant changes in the centre partnership? And I think if Ringrose does come in alongside Aki, it'll be the 26th different centre partnership Joe Schmidt has had in his time in Ireland, that suddenly the responsibility shifts from different people. So Henshaw is gone, so suddenly maybe Bundy Aki needs to be a bit more vocal than he needed to be the week before, yet he still feels he's sort of learning the international game.
And also, when he doesn't feel as though he's a mainstay in the team to really boss it, I remember certainly in the last number of years, and I was lucky that I got quite a lot of caps quite young, so I felt very comfortable in that environment, and I felt that my communication, I was never afraid to over talk. Sometimes players are a bit conscious of not being too chirpy, or you know, not being too loud, or trying to be too domineering in their communication. That never concerned me, particularly in defence. So Bundy coming in there, there's nothing like it from a winger's perspective, or inside or outside you as a 12 as well, where you're shouting exactly what you're doing in defence, because it takes a fitness to do that as well, to constantly communicate. And one of the most enjoyable things I like hearing and watching England is listening to the ref mic, of how much you hear Owen Farrell. He's one of the best communicators I've heard in defence. He has non-stop chat, and it's about getting guys off the ground. Peter Omani's pretty good for it, and Sean O'Brien's pretty good. You hear them an awful lot in the referee mic as well, about just telling players what they need to do. Particularly young guys, constantly being exposed to, you know, different messaging. Get up off the ground, I need you here, plug this hole, I want you over there on guard. Just to be able to push the defence into the sequence that you wanted, and you've been there so many times that, you know, you need it done that way in that format.
Is there almost too much reliance then on Johnny Sexton for the leadership?
Well, the thing is, you can organise as much as you want in attack, and that's what Johnny's doing. I'd say he's probably calling a lot of the phase play as well. Now that Jarrod Payne isn't around, it was well documented that Jarrod Payne's communication is one of his real strong points, and I think that they probably missed that a small bit. But in defence, you really need to be vocal in the outside channel, particularly at 13. I think that's that you could be the defensive leader out there, because you see a lot without, and you see it all unfolding at 15, but it's very hard to communicate that into everyone. Whereas at 13, you know, you're still within shouting distance of a huge number of defenders. You're with your winger as well, and you're able to see when you need to be soft, or when you need to be hard up, when you're numbered off. And it's those small things. When you're numbered off, there's no point in drifting anymore. That's why you've got to be aggressive and take that line speed and shut the gate as well.
So is Ringrose able to do that?
Yeah, he is. He's very
so little rugby.
He's very good at. He's a very, very good reader
like
of the game.
He's not really worried that someone might get the home put him being a bit too vocal.
No. I don't know what he's like. It's very difficult to know. I don't think he's as vocal as Jarrod Payne, but because he's quite a quiet guy. Now, I try and see his communication and how much he appears to be shouting on the pitch. I think he's able to read it himself. I don't know how vocal he is in doing it, but he's definitely able to close gaps and shut the space down on his own, and working in tandem. Whether that's being verbalised with his winger and his centre, I'm not entirely sure. You need to train with someone to fully appreciate that. And I never properly did train with him in the same team.
You think it's nailed on that if Ringrose is fit, and obviously he's missing out getting the game time with Leinster this week, that he does come in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Joe Schmidt won't want to move Keith Earls from the wing into centre. He's definitely a better winger than he is a centre.
What's Ringrose form been like this year?
Yeah, when it's been pretty reasonable. He's, you know, he's had that long shoulder injury, big surgery, and then was back for a while. He possibly hasn't been as good as last year, but he set some pretty high standards, and very hard to get into any kind of run of games if you've, you know, been out for a long period, and they've picked up, you know, a second injury back in January, was it? So yeah, he's been pretty good, but maybe not as good as last year's standards.
Liam Toland was writing during the week about the damage the teams are inflicting when they have just 33% possession and half the lineouts. And so Ireland's defensive problems, and Joe Smith has understandably come out and defended Andy Farrell this week, saying he's world class. Is there any sense, what we saw against Wales, that Andy Farrell gave away some of his secrets during the Lions tour, and teams have started to figure out what he's all about?
Yeah, possibly. I don't know. Again, you know, looking from the outside, it doesn't look as though he's changed the Irish defence massively from what he was doing pre-Lions. So a lot of that messaging must have been similar. You still have to attack against it. You still, you know, if the defence is set and you have good width, you still have to pick the right option to get to the extremity, or you still have to wear a team down to be able to earn that right to get into the wider channels. So I wouldn't be focusing so much. I think there's more of an onus on those wide players, and I'd be really interested to see how Gary Ringrose does cope with it, having been out for, you know, a number of months and not gotten a lot of game time, because I do think he reads it extremely well. Chris Farrell did a great job and defensively and in general carrying the ball forward last weekend, and he's brutally unlucky to have a serious knee injury, innocuously by the sounds of things at training. But I think it's a collective thing. It's the 13 setting that the defensive system nice and wide, but everyone has to appreciate that too. Get their spacings correct, not try and honeypot around the ruck, you know, having, you know, three or four defenders inside the first receiver. You can't have that. You've got to have, you know, probably the third defender lined up on the out half or whoever's the first receiver, and then get your line speed from there.
All our rugby coverage here on Off the Ball is with thanks to Vodafone, official sponsor of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us. We should start looking ahead to Scotland. I presume in camp, they're only talking about Scotland. Are you thinking about England already when there's such a quick turnaround?
Now, sometimes what would have happened in the bye weeks that you might have had a quick look to another team. You know, potentially England might have gotten an hour or two's conversation either last week or maybe even after the first two games. Because it's, you know, they'll definitely see that as being, you know, the focal point of the tournament, and maybe they need an extra little bit of understanding. It's set up magnificently for them now. You have to give respect to Scotland the way, you know, they played against England last weekend. But the big question about Scotland is, can they do it away from home? Which is something that they've, you know, has proved elusive to them for the last number of years. Great performance against England. No massive shock. It was always going to be a tough game. But now they have to get on the road and they've got to prove that they can perform like that against a good Irish team in the Aviva. And I think if they do go and beat Ireland there, well, then we'll start properly respecting them. But until they do that, I think they'll be seen as a home team.
Do you want that sort of pressure that you're talking about there, spoken about in camp, where you're saying, like, this is a massive opportunity now for Ireland to go and win a championship, win a Grand Slam? Do you want to be hearing that as a player, that, like, these are once in a lifetime for many players?
Yeah, they're not thinking championship. They're really not thinking championship. They are thinking slam. And they don't want to talk about it. And all the questions being fielded, you know, Joe Schmidt or anyone else has asked about it, of course. Because you have to give the respect to Scotland as well that they do deserve, particularly off the back of some of their, you know, that performance against England. So if you do take an eye off that, you could become unstuck. But ultimately, this team, the vast majority of them have two championships. Yes, there's, you know, the Stockdales and the James Ryans that have come in, but a lot of the players that have been there the last 5-6 years, they have two championships from 14 and 15. And what's eluded them is the slam. And that's all they're thinking about.
How do we get Finn Russell to play like the fly half that played against France and not the guy that played against England? And before you answer that, it's the first time we've had you in since we saw that weekend's games. The pass to Jones, like, it's high risk. It's off his supposedly weaker side into traffic. It's an intercept try under the posts if it goes wrong. Like, does Joe Schmidt want Johnny Sexton throwing passes like that, or is it too high risk?
Well, I think you don't have to throw that against Scotland because I don't think their defence is like England, but Gregor Townsend, huge credit to him and his analysts, because that's where England are vulnerable. They present so high on the outside, but you got to be brave to throw that pass. Now, that was an exceptional pass. I wouldn't be throwing too many of those, being brutally honest, but there was
one of your BT Sport buddies said on Wednesday night that it was the greatest pass he's ever seen.
It's up there.
I can't recall a better one.
It's up there. It absolutely is. Matched by the brilliant line by Hugh Jones as well, where he saw it, didn't have to break stride. Massive bravery in throwing that, in knowing exactly what he was doing. No, because it was phase play, so he got to his place. I think it was pre-planned that they wanted to attack those wide channels. There was something earlier on where it didn't look as though it's on. They push really hard. Sent 13 and wingers push really hard into the space to frighten you into not throwing those passes, to push you back inside, which is exactly what they want. But if you're willing to potentially have one picked off or be close to being picked off, well, you're going to get some good outcomes. And Scotland's analysis of England, of going to that space and a number of times the way they did, huge credit for doing so, because not many teams have been able to do that. You can only also do that off good quality ruck ball as well, and Scotland's rucking comparatively to England's was way more impressive. I think they were led away with murder by Nigel Owens. I could sympathise in some regard with England the way the game was adjudicated. I thought John Barkley was let have an absolute field day. There's no such thing as a ruck. There was no ruck. You know, this the new rules of one player over the over the ball now constituting a ruck. There was none of those rules in that game. At times we saw three and four bodies piled
Barkley
was piled
onto that,
in.
Wasn't he? Like he played it
well.
Minutes in,
he played it well. As I understand the rules, that I don't think he should have had that.
Yeah.
That
but
leeway.
He, knew
but
it
he played at 100%. When you're playing with Nigel, Nigel's gonna he wants it open and he wants it loose. And one where Barkley, like, literally the ruck was formed for a second and a half, and Barkley came from an offside position, reached in at the side and plucked the ball, and Nigel said, "Play on." It must be very frustrating, but at the same time, you know what referee you're getting. You analyse the referee as much as you analyse the opposition. So, there's absolutely the exact same with Ireland France this year. Nigel was, you know, kind of let it just play. He wants those open games. He's renowned for them. So you do know what's coming in advance of getting him refereeing at your match.
Yeah, there is a consistency, actually. Then if you're five minutes in, you realise you got away with it a couple of times, he's not suddenly going to change his mind 20 minutes in.
Referees rarely do. Or if they do, it's to, you know, maybe when a team is running away with it, just to pull the score back in a small bit. When the game's, you know, a done deal, you might, you know, start being a bit stricter. But yeah, you do know with certain referees. And I'm glad that we have Wayne Barnes for the Scotland game, because he's a lot more strict on the ruck. He won't have any of that where players are allowed to slow the ball down as well for, you know, a couple of seconds, and he'll let them away with it because he doesn't want to have a high penalty count. That won't bother him. You can be sure Wayne Barnes will penalise someone within the first 45 seconds, minute. Definitely, to lay down the law. Someone doesn't roll away from the ruck, bang, penalty. He wants them to know he's the boss, and that'll happen.
So that'll actually be interesting to watch over those opening couple of minutes, whether Scotland have learnt that over the past couple of weeks and haven't almost got cocky that, geez, we can get away with pretty much anything here.
Yeah, but John Barkley's such a savvy player that he'll know that he won't get away with what he got away with Nigel Owens, with Wayne Barnes. I don't know if Gregor goes and talks to the referee, or, you know, if Joe Schmidt goes and takes that opportunity to talk to the referee before the game. I think you'll see a very differently refereed game with Wayne Barnes. I'm not saying it'll favour Ireland, but it'll favour not having the looseness that was the game against England.
Yeah. You sort of feel watching Ireland, the way that they sort of build slowly and don't make many mistakes, and the discipline was very good against Wales, that it's a game plan that can work home our way. What you're saying about Scotland, actually, are they still at that stage under Gregor Townsend? And maybe it'll always be the case with Scotland that when they're at home, when they have the crowd behind them, when they're really up for it, they know they have the confidence to do that. But against 50,000 Irish people at the Aviva Stadium, that maybe that confidence seeps away quite quickly. Are there signs there that actually maybe that opening game against Wales wasn't one off, where it was a very quick learning curve for them, and the Scotland we saw against England is somewhere near the medium?
They went to Australia and won last summer, which was maybe one early sign that that's starting to change a little bit.
I don't think they're afraid to play, but you have to have, I suppose it's about what ruck ball you're able to generate for yourself. I didn't see the Scotland Australia game. I saw the one in November where they smashed them off the park when Scott Seo got sent off after 20 minutes, and it was done after that. They pushed New Zealand very close at home, but those away games, the victory against Australia, but then they went and lost to Fiji the following week. So the only way you get real respect in world rugby is winning away from home. And yes, you can, you know, pick off some big nations at home, and we did that for years. But that's why I think this yes, this game against Scotland is very important, but irrespective of what happens in that, I think the game in Twickenham is a huge game for the growth of this Irish team. Because if you want to do anything in the World Cup year, you've got to go to really difficult places and go and perform. And I think that's such a great test of this Irish team, going to Twickenham against an England team that will really be hopefully wanting to stop a Grand Slam, but to right some of the wrongs of last weekend too. So I think it's a brilliant opportunity for Joe Schmidt, and he'll see it as that. He'll know that he's won in Paris a number of times. He's beaten England in the Aviva. He's won down in South Africa for the first time. You know, beat New Zealand a couple of years ago for the first time. England away from home is something that he hasn't done. We haven't won there since 2010, I don't think. So they'll definitely want to put that right.
Before we let you go, one of your long-time colleagues and teammates, and a man you enjoyed incredible success with winning practically everything, Jamie Heaslip, announced his retirement this week at a very young age. And it's only when you look back that he was nominated for World Player of the Year as recently as 2016. He's played such little rugby since then. It has a real feeling that it's very, very premature, that he would still have had a huge amount to offer Ireland.
I think it's because he was never injured in advance of that. And it was so well documented about. I was reading an article in the Irish Times with Gerry Thornley talking about his consistency of performance, averaging 29 games a season, which for any Irish international is huge numbers. He was an 80-minute man. And it wasn't just that. He never sat out training. He always trained. I went on two Lions tours with him in 2009 and 2013, and he never once got treatment from a physio in either of them.
What?
Yeah. To not get anything done. Like not have a dead leg or I've got a bit of a tight calf.
And
nothing.
Is it that he didn't actually have any niggles or like, that he was
well,
just more
well, it doesn't matter through. Which it is because, you know, he's a very tough player. He was, you know, he was hard, very, very hard. But just durability like I'd never seen. Just and the way he plays as well, like he's, you know, he's got footwork and he has evasion skills. So how you don't get a leg trapped somewhere or a knee ligament issue of some kind, that's not flukiness.
I'd say that goes down well on a Lions tour.
I don't know. I don't know who pointed it out to me. I don't think it was Jamie, in fairness, that pointed it out to me. But I remember talking to. Yeah, some of the physios, Bob Stewart, one of the physios that I would have known over the last number of tours, and I think he mentioned it to me in Australia that no one treated Jamie, and just talking about how much of a freak he was. So it's pretty ironic that he does get an innocuous career-ending injury the way he did before the England game in the Aviva last year. So
what was he like as a character in the dressing room?
He's his own person. He's pretty quirky in his own way. I think you guys, you know, only know too well that he had a bit of a love-hate relationship with the media. I think in time he might look back on that, and I definitely look back on my early years of falling out with a couple of journalists and thinking I wish I could go back and tell my younger self. There's no point. There's nothing to be gained from that. There really isn't. You have to. I got it before the end that, you know, the media are part of what you do, but there's no place for having a negative relationship with anyone in the media. You only come off second best with it. So I think retrospectively he'll look back and maybe
he
could have been
won't.
Easier. Maybe he
he's
won't.
He's kind of carefree in that regard. And yeah. As you say, he's always done his own thing. You always got the impression the game wasn't the be-all and end-all for him. When he was in the zone and needed to be professionally, there was no one more focused. But when he didn't need to be in that zone, he just switched off completely and just did his own thing and went off in other directions.
He was a big game player. You know, for any of the Ireland's big victories or Leinster's big victories, he was a mainstay in that and had big performances. You look on Leinster and they're in rude health with, you know, Conan at 8 and Levy and Sean O'Brien and Rhys Ruddock and Van der Fleer and all these guys. But as great an athlete as Conan is, I don't think he's as savvy as Jamie Heaslip. He might get there. He's still a young guy. But Jamie's ability to clean up and plug holes and make other players look good was pretty unrivaled. Maybe Shane Jennings was close with him on it, but I think he will really be missed, and it'll be hard on Jamie too. The shape that this team is in, looking down the barrel of a World Cup in 18 months, because I think we do have a great opportunity with how South Africa and France are at the moment. We've, you know, the Celtic nations have a great chance, particularly us, to do something we've never done before, and God forbid even go beyond a semi-final. So
yeah, we don't really think about that side of it at all, actually. He's been working his ass off for 18 months.
That's brutal for him.
Trying to get back
to
this reason.
That's brutal because, like myself, he disappointed at World Cups because we never got it done. We never got beyond a quarter final. And he obviously had the two quarterfinals. I don't think he made the World Cup team or in 2007, no. But 11 and 15, two quarterfinals, two disappointments. So he would have seen this as an opportunity to do something brilliant with it, with a team that has great potential. So that's I feel for him with that.
Was he very much a Schmidt mold player? Did his job?
Yeah. Do you know what? Where I watched a play at the weekend. This is the best way to describe it. I watched a play, and CJ Stander did an okay job with it. But there's a set play where midfield scrum, and you get out to the wide channel, and Bundiaki threw a pass, but then held out on the wing, and then Conor Murray throws, does a loop play infield with Peter O'Mahony, who throws it to Bundy, who's on the wing coming in blind, like you see Rob Kearney coming in behind the ruck the whole time. And Stander cleaned the ruck. What you're meant to do is clean it really deep, so the defender on the far side of the ruck has no opportunity to come back on the scramble. Jamie was absolutely brilliant at sealing those things off, at doing that little role of just holding someone, a little tug,
a
little blocker, yeah. without being obvious. And I used to always keep an eye for the power plays for him, because he was usually a telltale that something was coming. Mm. And Standard, you know, who was it? Gareth Davis managed to get a scrag tackle from that negative defender coming around. But Jamie was just absolutely brilliant at doing that stuff. And his attention to detail was exceptional. I always loved having him in the team, because I did feel that we were in great shape physically and mentally, because he was mentally a very, very tough player.
All right, great stuff. Thanks for coming in, Brian. We'll chat to you again over the next couple of weeks. All our Six Nations coverage on Off the Ball is with thanks to Vodafone, official sponsor of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.